Okay, this is Karen Brewster, and today is July 19th, 2022, and I'm here with Don Corwin, the National Park Service office in Eagle, Alaska, and I managed to corner Don to talk to him for an old project on the Klondike National Historical Park and the work he did there in Skagway way back in the day. So thank you, Don, for agreeing to be interviewed.
My pleasure.
And I guess the fact that it was raining, I was able to corral you today.
Good timing.
Good timing. So to get us started, if you can just tell me a little bit about yourself, your background, where you came from.
Sure. I came to Alaska in 1973 as a refugee from the counterculture war that was going on down in the southern states, specifically California, trying to avoid going to Vietnam, being in draft age category status. And so I had a professor that recommended that I go to the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. Because the population of Alaska was so small that they didn't draft people in Alaska.
Oh.
They had more volunteers than they needed.
Hmm.
So I was in Fairbanks for about 5 years, and I worked on the pipeline. And after that, there was a huge economic crash in Alaska, and I decided to look around and explore some of the areas that I had briefly passed through. So I went to places like Talkeetna, McCarthy, Homer, Haines, and I really did like Haines, but I couldn't find any type of work there. So on the spur of the moment, I just decided to go to Skagway for the 4th of July weekend because I'd heard they have a pretty good series of events over there. So I took the ferry over to Haines, and it was remarkable because you start to pull up to the town and you see the ore terminal there, and you don't realize that you're actually arriving. You think that you're in a logging camp or something like that and expect something totally different, and you proceed to get off the ferry and then go uptown, and you're immersed in a truly gold rush era town that is mostly boarded up and vacant and looks like a movie set from a Wild West magazine or movie.
Mm-hmm.
And dirt streets. And Skagway at that time was enjoying a prolific amount of railroad activity because of the mining that was going on in the Yukon. So the ore would come down on the train. There was still a little bit of the old Princess cruise line steamship tourism going on. And then the road was being built, which was a pretty defining moment in time for Skagway. So I show up in Skagway for the 4th of July weekend, and they tell me that they're going to have this big ceremony to dedicate a brand new national park. So they've got a stage set up in the middle of the town, and there's a number of speeches and all that, and they're talking about the Chilkoot Trail and a number of buildings downtown that are going to be restored. And that all sounded pretty good to me. So the next Monday morning, I went to their office and I said, well, who's going to do all this work? And they go, well, why do you ask? And I said, well, I'm an unemployed carpenter from the pipeline. Well, here you go. Here, fill out these papers. And that started me down a road that led to a career working for the National Park Service. I was very fortunate because I got in really on the ground floor, like probably the number two maintenance employee in Skagway at that time. One of my first jobs was actually digging up graves out in Dyea, where a cemetery was being washed away, and we had to move the graves to a more secure location, and that was quite a undertaking due to living relatives of those interred people, and it was a big event in the newspapers and all that kind of stuff. But it really dawned on me just how important Skagway had been at that point in time, because one of the graves we moved was James Mason, and he was Skookum Jim.
Oh.
One of the original Discovery participants of the Klondike Gold Rush, along with another Native gentleman and a white prospector and his Native wife. Literally found the gold laying in a creek, mm-hmm. and started the gold rush.
And so what year was this that you went to Skagway?
1977.
Okay. And that cemetery, was that the Native cemetery, or that was the Avalanche cemetery?
Well, it was considered the city cemetery.
Okay. In Dyea.
Right.
Okay.
And the river in Dyea has meandered, so it is still moving around and revealing parts of the old town site and stuff like that. And we moved maybe 8 or 10 graves, I would guess.
Where did you put them?
In the Slide Cemetery.
Okay.
That was the Avalanche Cemetery. So sometimes we had headstones, other times we just had more or less depressions in the ground and knew that there was something there that we were going to find. And it was truly 6 feet down in the ground.
Wow, they were able to dig them that deep.
Yeah.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And the amount of material that was still intact was substantial in 100 years. The ground's, of course, pretty cold.
Right.
And, you know, there were things like shoes or clothing and jewelry and hardware on coffins and stuff like that. So I got to build new coffins out of plywood to reinter these graves. So at the early part of the Park Service in Skagway, the main focus was on stabilizing the buildings on Broadway. And typically that involved going in and essentially digging underneath the buildings to create a foundation. And then, of course, making sure that the roofs were stable or intact so that everything in between could be renovated. And we had crews of people that were what we called the Mole Patrol, and that your entire job was more or less crawling around underneath these buildings and scraping out the riverbed. Skagway in itself is essentially a riverbed. So lots of time was spent pulling a trouble light, and you also had to have a jack and a pad to set it on so that you could shore up these buildings and make these little tunnels so that the building could be lifted up and then a concrete foundation would be put underneath it.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering when you said you were digging under the building. You did eventually have to elevate the buildings, right?
Yeah. There were some parts of buildings that had sunk more than 2 feet into the ground.
Wow.
And they were built in a manner that the foundation was the least important part of the structure, really. So they were sort of built right on the ground with just timbers or blocks. And the Gold Rush era buildings on Broadway are really close together. So there are buildings that are essentially adjoining, roofs that overlap each other. And those were places where we'd find bottles and discarded building materials and all kinds of other things. Of course, the time period had tokens in that they were prevalent because there was a shortage of coinage in the Gold Rush towns. Mm-hmm. So we would find these tokens that were good for, like, say, 5 cents at the Mascot Saloon.
Which would be buying one beer, maybe?
Maybe so, yeah. Or the saloons were also kind of standard restaurant fare for the working men in a town. Now, one of my favorite occurrences took place when we were doing renovating a building called the Penile Mission. Mm-hmm. And the Penile Mission was a Salvation Army type shelter for Scandinavians. Mm-hmm. And they had, you know, kind of like a combination of bunks and soup kitchen, and they were trying to help these people that were newly immigrated to the United States. And we kind of developed almost a relationship with one of the people that ran this place, because for one thing, the newspapers were full of stories about this kind of stuff in those days, and all that Gold Rush history was readily available through the local library, you know, and also the Park Service. So we knew the names of people, and one of these couples that ran the Scandinavian Mission, her husband went to Nome and became a policeman. And while we were digging in the foundation, we found a policeman's badge from Nome.
Oh.
And evidently he had gotten to some point in his service where he was done with that. He threw the badge into the wood stove and it was disposed of in the ashes. So that was kind of interesting. And it just puts kind of a personal touch on some of these things that happened. There were so many interesting things that occurred during the Gold Rush with the people that were there, the people that were building there, and of course the history of some of the major events. So I worked for the Park Service for many years and became a teacher in a program that was nationwide to promote preservation and skills training. My specialty in Skagway was making windows and doors for the buildings that we restored. And so I would have to build entire buildings worth of buildings, or of windows and doors. And, you know, that may take all winter long to do something like that. Okay. And we had a really good shop.
Mm-hmm. And you were building windows and doors to replicate what they would have looked like in the Gold Rush era?
Yes.
And so how did you learn how to do that?
I would say that it was primarily because I had a burning desire to do it. And I taught myself, and I researched different methods of Finnish carpentry. There's a lot of books from different countries that are available that detail, like, say, door and window construction in England, as an example. And then, of course, a lot of those techniques were brought to the Americas, and they used the same kind of tools, right? And then later on, as the Industrial Revolution came about in our country, better tools were developed. And so if you look at the name of a company like Stanley, mm-hmm. it goes way, way back. But they're based on tools that were in existence before America existed. So I learned how to do that, and I was given the opportunity to develop those skills, and got an opportunity to teach other people, which was really great. The past program that I was in, we would travel to other parts of the United States as a group. I had two students from Alaska, one from Sitka and one from Wrangell St. Elias. And we would do projects across the United States as a group. So we went to, like, Yosemite, we went to St. Augustine, Florida, and worked at different sites, such as a plantation in the south, some historic buildings outside of Washington, D.C., and a chance to not only see different projects across the United States, but to meet also our fellow workers and compare our experience. And that was great. It was kind of a team building exercise. And I'll never forget, I had an opportunity to talk to the guy back in Frederick, Maryland that built the windows and doors. And I asked him how he arrived at this one particular juncture in the process. And he asked me, well, how do you do it? And I told him, and he goes, that's the same. That's the most logical thing to do. And I said, that's pretty much how you get there, you know. So the methods sometimes reveal themselves. Uh-huh. If you can figure out which step to do first.
Well, did you look at drawings of old buildings, and you could look at what a window or door looked like, and because you know carpentry, you could figure it out?
Yes. And then when I was in the past program, we went to the Smithsonian to an exhibit that was specifically on windows and doors in America. And that, to me, was fascinating.
Yeah.
Because something as simple as glass has a long history going back to the Egyptians, really, in terms of how it was used, how it was manufactured, and people like Alexander Baranov, who was the famous Russian, and Sitka was actually a glassmaker from Russia.
Oh, I didn't know that. Well, and I do know from, you know, talking to the archaeologists like Kathy Spooty, you know, what they can find out by analyzing the glass bottles and the manufacturing and all that. So you say glass, it can tell you quite a bit. So the name of that program you just said was the what program?
PAST, P-A-S-T, Preservation and Skills Training. And it's still operating. I was recently working in Skagway this last winter, and one of the people that I was working with had just recently been accepted into that program. So it's good to further these programs to pass on skills that may be lost.
Yeah, and so you're learning from each other. Like, say you went to Frederick, Maryland, and you learned from those folks, and they were teaching you things, and then you bring it back to your park.
Exactly.
And were there people from the lower 48 that came up to Skagway who worked with you and you taught them? Or did you always do the traveling?
I can't recall specifically if there were people from the lower 48, but a lot of times people from other parks in Alaska would come to Skagway. Mm-hmm. Because we had the shop.
Right.
And as a matter of fact, there was a guy from right here in Eagle, mm-hmm, that came to Skagway and got some training. And so a lot of times they would have me go to different places and teach skills. Mm-hmm. So as an example, one time I went to Denali and worked with their crew of people, and I told them that they had everything that they needed to build windows, they just didn't know it.
Right.
And that these machines were just kind of sitting around in the corner collecting dust and nobody knew what they did.
Right.
But they were perfectly adequate.
Well, doesn't the Park Service have a National Historic Preservation group or something that goes around and works on projects? I can't think of what it's called, but based in Virginia or West Virginia, the training, the preservation
you're
training.
You're thinking of Harper's Ferry.
Yes, that's it. Thank you.
Harper's Ferry is more a the people that do the preservation of artifacts.
Okay.
Now, I have a woman friend that I met in Kodiak who, her specialty is taxidermy.
Mm-hmm.
And so she travels around and does museum exhibits of birds, or she went to, I'm not sure if it was Valdez, but there was a turtle.
Oh.
That was found by a commercial fisherman.
Oh.
And it's in the museum, and it needed some preservation work because it never stopped exuding some kind of turtle oil. And so, anyways.
But so Harper's Ferry provides trainings for like artifact preservation and archival,
right,
stuff. They don't provide training for historic building preservation?
The
construction
the
stuff?
Location that I was at in Maryland does that.
Okay.
So they have crews that, like, say, they'll go work at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Now, recently, something crossed my plate where they were looking for some specific needs for the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier.
Oh.
Right? So you've got all these historic locations, and the Maryland group can put together the specific people, and there's one guy from Skagway that went there to go to work on that crew. And they are not only a training facility, but a specialized construction aspect of the Park Service.
Right, and so how come that group wasn't sent to do Klondike, that Klondike created its own team?
It wasn't considered to be effective to keep sending people to the ends of the earth. It's better to train them on the spot.
Okay.
And also, I believe that's part of the legislation that's in ANILCA that says that they will train and develop people's skills.
Okay.
Which I think is something that gets forgotten at times, but is an important aspect of what Alaskans should be entitled to in exchange for developing these huge national park areas.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Skagway was a good example because the argument was, okay, we took all these buildings off the tax payroll.
Right.
What are we going to get out of it? You know? Well, we'll develop a place that people will want to come see. So it became a destination.
Right. Yeah, I mean, my understanding is when the Park Service was first starting in Skagway, the local community was not always an enthusiastic supporter.
That's true. There was, I think in Alaska as a whole, some of that anti-Sierra Club type mentality. Now, I happen to have an interest in how that came about up out here on the Yukon River.
Yes.
At a specific time.
Right.
But also there were places like McCarthy and Denali where there was essentially civil unrest.
Right.
As a result of that protest.
Right. And that's why I was thinking that for Skagway, how it manifested itself there, and if you experienced that.
There was a certain amount of, I'm not sure the correct word to use, but negative aspect to the Park Service. But for the most part, what happened was you either came and took part and for a while, or, you know, some people stayed, they started families, they became locals. So I guess you'd say that was what happened to me. I was there
right.
for over 40 years.
Right, I was going to say you were kind of that in between. You had just arrived, and so you kind of were an outsider getting a job, but you made that your home.
Yes. One of the things that the park relied on me for was to be able to go to different locations and essentially exhibit the qualities of being an Alaskan local, and that I could go to, let's say, Dutch Harbor. I worked there for a number of times on the Russian Orthodox Church. And initially, they wouldn't even let me in the building. But eventually, they became comfortable with me being there to the point where I was accepted. So, I think the fact that Alaska is such a small place has a great deal of impact on people going to these remote communities. Eagle's the same way.
Right.
I sometimes get negative reactions from people in Eagle, even now.
Right, and you've been coming and working in Eagle for how long?
Oh, since 95.
Yeah.
So more than 20-some years.
Well, and that's what I was thinking. In Skagway, you know, the the fact that, well, they were going to make this a tourist destination, so that was something, a benefit for the community, was also the Park Service provided a lot of jobs for local people, if they were willing to take them, but right. It did provide a benefit.
Right. That was an important part of the economy. When the railroad closed in 82, the Park Service made an effort to pick up unemployed railroad workers, and that had a big impact on the community.
So how did you get from crawling around under the buildings to being the window and door guy?
Well,
something happened in between.
Yeah. I look back on it, and there was a defining moment where I actually went to my bosses and I said, I can do better than the people you've got doing better now, doing that job now. And if I can't, then I'm going to quit. And they gave me a shot. And so I just wanted it so bad that I went after it. Now, I have to admit that there was a certain amount of realizing that it's better to be working in a shop than behind the table saw than crawling around underneath the building. So that was pretty obvious.
So how long were you working on the buildings before you made that switch? Like the first summer, or was it years, or...
It took a while to get to that level of production. The early years were more or less just stabilizing the buildings, and so we didn't do that level of work. I would say it might have been up to like 5 years.
Okay. Yeah, until they got to the point where they needed the fine detail work. Okay.
And they did bring in supervisors from outside that helped to develop the skill levels. So I had a boss that in the early days that had originally been a preservation person in Boston.
Who was that?
His name was Pete Bathurst, and he ran one of the earlier crews in Skagway, and he helped us to develop our woodworking talents and also to invest in a facility that was capable of doing that type of work. Because they could have had it all sent in from outside.
Right, yeah.
Instead, they decided that building it locally and creating a resource, not just for Skagway, but for the whole state of Alaska. And I, at times, would have special projects where I was building windows and doors for other agencies across Alaska.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's interesting that, you know, that shop and that maintenance facility, it was state of the art, and that they had to create that. It wasn't there.
And it's still considered to be a huge resource.
Yeah. And I was wondering, too, how you learned all this. And you said that they did bring some of the crew leaders from other places who had done some of this type of stuff before.
Mostly as supervisors, not actually hands-on people, but the people that ran the crews and supervised the level of work. The planning mostly came out of the Denver Service Center.
Right.
And so they would have a team of architects study and come up with a very precise set of plans for what the building would be representing when it was completed. And of course, they had ideas about the intended use of buildings, whether it was to be a visitor center or some kind of museum display or
a bunkhouse.
Right. Some of the buildings were actually restored with the idea that they would be what they call leasebacks. So they were rented out to local businesses in a historic setting on the main street in Skagway.
And that affected the idea of the future use, affected how the restoration worked in the plan?
Well, the types of buildings that were selected for restoration and had to be purchased from the private sector specifically for the park kind of had their own story to tell. Each, whether it was the Mascot Saloon, obviously the greatest use of that building would be to recreate a saloon setting from 1898 and show people what a place like that was like at that time period on the western frontier. And so there were other places that were businesses or I guess you'd say that it could range from anybody that when the automobile came in, they sold Model A Ford parts or vehicles to the guy that was the local mortician. And so there were the typical types of businesses in terms of haberdashery would be a term from that time period.
Right.
A clothing store, a meat market from the Gold Rush area was very interesting in terms of how it was set up, because although there was ice that was being moved around, that was before refrigeration, right, really. So it just portrayed the whole gamut of what kind of lifestyle and business took place in a frontier town, like, say, in 1900.
Mm-hmm.
And so each building would have a specific time period that it was targeted to represent. And its period of influence.
Right.
So, you know, we would have years when there was big projects, because these were being funded as direct congressional appropriations, and there were years when we would have small projects. And for the most part, the park was a consistent employer.
Right.
So if you really wanted to pursue that type of work, it was there. And then if you wanted to become part of the park system on a national level, you could also use your background in Skagway as a way to move on.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, like I said, I know a guy now that's working in Washington, D.C.
who started in Skagway.
Right.
So was it seasonal work, or did you have year-round work?
I would say both, really, in that it took a while for them to get to the point where they felt that it was justifiable to try to work year-round.
Well, I would assume it also depended on what you were working on a particular building. There's certain things you can't do in the winter in Skagway outside, but if you were working on the finished carpentry inside the building, maybe you could work in the winter.
Right.
Or you're building your doors and windows in the shop.
Although the level of technology has changed somewhat so that they can actually create a tent around a building to work outside in the wintertime and heat it.
Yeah.
Like, say, because the cruise ship industry is such that they can't occupy the street scene in the summertime, so some jobs have to be done in the off season.
Oh, okay. But when you were starting back in the 70s, it was probably much more seasonal.
Cause, right, yeah.
I mean, you couldn't be digging under the buildings in the winter. No. I don't know if the ground was frozen.
It was just miserable.
Yeah. So do you have a particular building that was your favorite to work on?
Well, I would say that the Mascot Saloon is one of the buildings that represents what I consider to be a important part of my life. And I had the chance to do some work on it this last winter, and I see windows and doors that I made 30 years ago, whatever, and they just still have almost like an internal glow to them. And something about the varnish was just right. And of course, nowadays, to be able to get the type of building materials like that is more difficult. Whereas in those days, it was still the heyday of the old growth virgin forest from the Pacific Northwest, which is more or less gone now. So the materials and the tools and the time period were all important. And although I don't choose to live there full time anymore, Skagway is a really fun place.
Yeah.
And there are some really incredible places that you can get to that are nearby.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not have a horizon. It's in a fjord, so.
Right.
Yeah, as some people say, you're at the bottom of the ditch.
Right. Well, you can look out at the ocean, but you're right. You are in a narrow passage there. And I can tell you in the winter, those winds come down there from the glaciers. It is cold.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, it is.
But you were talking about the material, and I had been thinking to ask you about the glass and the wood. Okay, that was old growth, or, you know, modern wood works the same, right? But the glass of 1900 is different than the way glass is made now, and I think it would look different. So was there something you did to replicate it to look old?
Well, glass is a unique material, and it can be around for a long, long time, and mainly the emphasis on historic preservation is to try to salvage as much as possible. And some people go to the extent of trying to buy fake old glass, but we didn't do that. But if we couldn't salvage historic glass, we would just use new glass. And that there's a certain philosophy of preservation that says that if you can find a picture of what it looked like in 1898 and you took a black and white photograph of it today, will it look the same? And glass is one of those things that you wouldn't be able to tell in a photograph.
Okay.
So, also, there are certain requirements nowadays in terms of safety and stuff like that. So, our hands weren't tied, but we do have to conform to some building codes.
Right. Well, that's a good point. I hadn't thought about that. Especially like someplace like the Pinal Mission where people are living there as
right.
employees. That fire egress and things like that.
And some of the storefronts in Skagway have huge pieces of glass and what would be considered a fairly substantial earthquake zone.
Hmm.
And so that glass should be as safe as possible in the event of a catastrophic
right.
event.
Right. Well, and when you said you would salvage old glass, were there big enough pieces? I mean, if you're making a new window that's 4x4, you don't necessarily have a 4x4 piece of glass. You can't fuse it together, can you?
No.
No.
No, but typically in the gold rush period, the technology was that it's what they call float glass. And what they mean is that they actually pour liquid glass on top of a tank full of liquid tin. And the glass and the tin are close enough in temperature to be liquid that one floats on top of the other. And of course, anything at atmospheric pressure is pretty much dead on flat, which is what you want for a piece of glass.
Right.
And so then they developed the technology to be able to pick up that floating piece of glass and pull it up vertically through rollers.
Oh.
And that's how they made it a uniform thickness.
Wow.
And all of this while it's still in a semi, a state that's between a liquid and a solid.
Right.
Sort of
like rolling pasta through a pasta maker.
Sure, yeah.
But with, wow.
And so a lot of the windows were smaller because of the technology to make the glass. So a typical, what they would call a double hung window,
mm-hmm.
the old style like your grandmother's house,
right.
where they slide in a frame.
Right.
If you had a piece of glass that was bigger than 30 inches in any direction, that would be unusual.
Okay.
And smaller. You'd have a combination of little 8x10 pieces that were separated by wood dividers.
Right. Those multi-pane glass windows.
Sure.
Things. Right.
Like on a sun porch or that's probably the most common reference is a addition to a house that's not necessarily a heated room.
Right.
That's occupied all the time but is essentially a sunroom.
Actually, I lived in a house that had a sun porch like that with all those little mm-hmm. panes of glass. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I had to do the sunroom on the what's now called the Kodiak History Museum was mm-hmm. originally the Russian storage building for
yeah.
sea otter pelts, and there was 163 little tiny pieces of glass that I had to take out every one and redo the paint and the putty that it sits in and
but
all that.
You were able to reuse all those pieces of glass, or you had to put some new ones in?
I had to put some new ones in.
But you
yeah.
used as many as you could?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I was thinking for the Skagway buildings, a lot of them maybe didn't have the glass in them anymore. I don't know how in what state of disrepair they were when you started.
It really was like walking into a movie set from a Western, and that typically the buildings were boarded up and vacant and didn't have any paint on them, and it just looked like a deserted town setting with a dirt street. Mm-hmm. And some were kind of falling down into the ground, and others had trees growing through the roof, and it was pretty incredible.
Yeah, a pretty incredible transformation to have seen it go from that to what it is today.
Yeah, I mean, a day like today in the summer, there could be 5 cruise ships.
Yeah.
Tied up in Skagway.
And so how did it work with the work crews, and how you interacted with the historic architects and implementing their plans? How did that all work? Or can you give me an example with one building, maybe?
Sure. Well, it was almost like a very special situation for everyone, in that the buildings were intact. Now, a good example of this would be the actual railroad depot and administration building, mm-hmm. a very prominent, pretty good sized complex right at the beginning of the town. And the railroad had abandoned the historic buildings and built themselves, let's say, a modern office building, probably in the early 60s. And so the architects would use it almost like a classroom setting. I can remember one time we had about a dozen architects being led by one of the more prominent leaders of this Denver Service Center group. And I found out recently that one of the architects that I worked with in Skagway is now the head of the Denver Service Center.
Oh, who's that?
I can't think of his last name right off the bat. But
I can't think of the name of the other architect who was from the Denver Service Center who did so much in Skagway. I can't think of his name right now.
I think I know who you mean. It'll come to me.
Okay.
But anyways, so because the railroad had used those buildings for a long period of time, we could probably say that 75 years, there had been some remodeling or renovation or changes done to the interior of the buildings, and all that stuff was getting removed to take it back to its true original historic state. And this one time we found some graffiti in a stairwell that referred to the famous builder of the White Pass, Michael Heaney.
Oh.
And his nickname was the Irish Prince. And he was supposedly very well liked by all the people that worked under him, except in this one instance when this graffiti was put on the wall and then covered up. And it just happened to be that it was the period of what we would call the Atlin Gold Strike. Now, Atlin is a little town in British Columbia that's maybe 40 miles over the mountains. Mm-hmm. And it had its own little gold rush. And everybody wanted to leave their job on the railroad and go to the gold strike. And so they wanted to get paid off. And Heaney decided that, first of all, he couldn't afford to do that. And second of all, they'd probably want to take their shovels. And those shovels were more valuable to him. And he wouldn't let them go. So, having traveled through those mountains and seen some of those, I remember finding a wheelbarrow in the middle of nowhere one time.
Wow.
Somebody had pushed it all the way from Skagway until they decided they weren't going to push it any further and just left it leaning up against a tree.
Right.
So,
do you remember what that graffiti said?
I do, and I would not repeat it.
Okay. Is it still on the wall in the building, or what?
It's still there, but it's covered up.
Right.
And so that was a very important find for those architects to see that, and also for the historians, because Heaney had this golden reputation of never doing any wrong, and yet here was this example of something that was true conflict.
Right. Well, I think there would probably be a lot of that in those old buildings, that these pieces of history that you find. And I know you guys had to work with the archaeologists underneath all those buildings.
Yep.
And that would be another one. How did that work? And did it work? Or what were the frustrations there?
Well, the main thing was that we had to follow procedure. And so, just like today, somebody working on a building site that's considered a historic spot, more than likely they're going to have an archaeologist attached to the project just to document or supervise what's going on so that the artifacts or whatever aren't destroyed or end up leaving the site if they're of any value, just to preserve the history. Mm-hmm. And so, because we had, you know, a number of people that were digging by hand, and then at times with machines, the architect or the archaeologists were an important part of that, just to see that they were being given the due that was part of the project. And so it was understandable that if something were to be uncovered that was of a sensitive nature, like human remains, or that sometimes the job would have to stop, or considerations were given so that some things weren't disturbed.
Mm-hmm. And so did the archaeologists go in under the buildings first and look for things and then tell you guys you could go ahead? Or you guys were in there digging first?
They would look at the surface, and then as we would go down through layers, they would also look at them. And sometimes they would dig a test pit mm-hmm. first to see if there were like layers of ash, or maybe you were in some place that there was a dump.
Right.
So that they could more or less establish a time period.
Right. Because I think you'd say you guys are in there digging, but you're not trained to what to look for digging. You're in there just to get the dirt out of the way
right.
to build the foundation. Yep. So how deep down did you guys go so you could put the buildings on new foundations?
Oh, I would say 4 feet plus.
Oh, okay. That's a lot of digging.
Yeah. Yeah. There was a lot of material that got removed it was interesting because sometimes you'd take that stuff out and you'd put it in the potholes in the alley, and then after it rained, the dirt would get washed away and the artifacts would be right there looking you in the face.
Oh, interesting. So. But of course, by then the archaeologist doesn't know where it came from.
Right.
Under the building, so they don't like that.
No, they want to discover things in their original setting.
Yes, definitely.
So they haven't been disturbed.
Yes. So the other thing I was wondering about, you mentioned tools, that for doing this kind of preservation work and renovation you were doing, did you need to make your own tools?
Sometimes, in the aspect of what's unique about Finnish carpentry from the late 1800s to, like, say, 1920 is that, and I use this example to describe what had taken place in America. There's a machine called a shaper, and it makes the molding profiles on all the fancy woodwork, like doors that have raised panels in them and windows that have divided lights with the smaller panes of lights and the wood, what would be called a muntin. So all those sculpted pieces of wood are the product of having been run through a shaper. And that machine dates back to before the Civil War. And the thing that has changed is that the way that the machine is powered. So originally those machines were being powered by huge belts that could have been turned by a water wheel or a steam engine. And now we have essentially the same type of machine being turned by an electric motor. So in terms of making tools, sometimes we would take blank pieces of steel and make the knives that would match a pattern on something that it was from a time period. So we would duplicate the molding.
Wow. So then you had to learn metalworking if you're making a knife. How did you know how to do that? Or is there a machinist in the crew that did it?
Well, that would be one of the things that would come through the preservation workshops that sometimes took place, where if I had the opportunity to go somewhere or somebody would come and visit our park and show us rudimentary ways to do that. And then, of course, different people developed different skills in terms of adapting to that, to the machines that they had. So it was something that I learned, and I would consider myself a toolaholic, right? So I would just accumulate the resources to do the best that I could possibly do.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I asked about making tools, because it seems like somebody at your level of talent and skill might be somebody who makes their own tools, because you want it to be done a certain way and there's nothing out there, so you make it yourself.
And then, of course, there's a lot of stuff, and this was pretty much before the internet, but you know, Alaskan always used to be a big catalog place in the wintertime.
Right.
And so there's tool catalogs from all over the world. And as as our ability to reach out to other parts of the world and use their technology. You find out things about how, let's say, the Japanese make their chisels, or how the oldest buildings made out of wood are either in Scandinavian countries, Russia, or in Japan. Mm-hmm. And so a handsaw in one country has some of the same features as a handsaw from the other side of the world, but the handles might be totally different. They might cut from the opposite end of the saw. It's just...
Or would it matter what kind of wood you're cutting? Are they specialized that, you know, it cuts spruce versus cutting bamboo or something?
Right, yeah. Yeah.
Interesting. I also was wondering, in Skagway, you know, the old railroad days and the old mining days, there were old tools you could scavenge. You know, there was something lying around in somebody's yard or out in the railroad yard that could be remodified.
A good example of that is that there was a huge fire in Skagway in about 1969, and it was called the Roundhouse Fire. So it was a huge railroad building where they worked on the train engines and stuff like that, and it had a turntable in there that mm-hmm. could move the equipment around in a circle. And they also had some pretty large pieces of woodworking equipment in there for building passenger cars and stuff like that. And this is where you get these crossover trades. The guys that could build a railroad car were just as competent as the guys that were building boats. Mm-hmm. Or maybe the guy that was building cabinets or coffins or any number of finished wooden detailed articles. And when this fire took place in Skagway in the railroad roundhouse, they just started dragging all these pieces of equipment outside to get it away from the fire. And the fire was so devastating that a lot of this equipment never got reused again. It just sat out there until at some point they decided to just, you know, clean up the yard and get rid of it. And one friend of mine had worked at the railroad for a while, and he got two of these big machines that sat out in his yard for a long, long time until I ran across a company down in Northern California that made stuff for Victorian architecture buildings that had these gigantic old style shaper machines. And I talked to the owner and I said, hey, you know, you have any interest in any of these old tools like that? He's going, do I ever? And so we actually sent him a couple of these railroad pieces of equipment from the fire, and he got them going.
Cool. Did you use any of the salvage things for your work?
No. They weren't. They were so much on an industrial scale that we couldn't, even though the way that they were powered, the electricity was different. Mm-hmm. It'd be like saying it was three-phase electricity, whereas in the shop where I was at, it was all single-phase. So it wasn't possible to use that type of stuff. But eventually, we got a new shop, and we were able to purchase state-of-the-art equipment for it. Yeah, I'm happy to say I would consider that shop still a very important resource in the Park Service for Alaska.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't realize it was used more broadly than just in Skagway.
There's always been a concept of having a team of people that can go to these remote places. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got to Eagle, was right. They sent me up here to work on the dredge because they needed to have somebody on site to restore all the windows in the dredge. And I did that several summers, starting in 95.
So in those early days in Skagway, when you're first working on those buildings, like how many guys, I'm saying guys, but I don't know that if there were women working on your crews.
Yes, there were, yeah.
How many people a crew would be every year?
I'd say up to about 20.
So there were women working on the crews.
Yes.
Starting from that first year?
Shortly thereafter, in the first several.
Do you remember who some of those first women were and what they did?
I would say that they were considered general labor. So they would have been part of the crew that were digging. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, some people would more aptly get a certain job because of their size or their strength. Or because they showed an interest in doing something.
So the women could fit under the buildings better? Is that what you're saying?
I wouldn't say better, but if they were willing to do it. Not everybody was willing to do it.
No. Well, I was also wondering how the women were accepted or treated.
I would say that. So this is after the hippie thing, right?
Yeah, this is the mid-70s, late-70s.
Yeah, early-80s.
Right.
So women's rights were being vocalized, and equality in the workplace was something that was beginning to show. And that a woman laborer, I believe, in the Park Service would have been paid the same as a male laborer, which wasn't always the case
right.
in a lot of places. But there was no doubt that some jobs were harder and more physical and just flat out dirty.
Right.
You know, but it was a different time period.
Right. Well, and that's why I asked. Like, yes, on paper it was equality in workplace and, you know, they were hired. That doesn't mean the guys on the job were ready to accept them and treat them equally. Different time. And that wondering how they were accepted and treated, you know, day to day on the ground.
Right. I would say for the most part that they were, I don't know if this is something that you can understand, but they were protected.
Oh.
So they were welcomed, and an effort was made to make sure that they'd want to stick around.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I would have, would have thought there would have been resentment or that guys wouldn't want these girls around. They would have maybe not been as nice to them or made life difficult for them.
I don't think I ever saw that. And that the camaraderie of people that get thrown into a mix like that is such that you are more apt to develop important friendships in a job situation like that.
So that's a good entree into that subject, the camaraderie amongst you guys, men and women, but the crew members, your camaraderie amongst the crew members, how that worked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's still people that I have long-standing friendships with from those early days of doing that have left Skagway, gone on to other careers. I can think of some of the other people in the Park Service that I've known over time that have gone on to be regional directors or superintendents and stuff like that, or had some major role in some of the larger parks in Alaska at a certain time. So in terms of the people that I was directly working with, there was a young lady in Skagway that took a interest in historic preservation, and last time I heard, she was working in Boston as a supervisor. And every once in a while, I hear something about her. Some of my male friends, you know, we still wish each other a happy birthday and get together when the time allows. And
so, the 20, you mentioned 20 people about, would that be on one building? And there was a 20 on another building? Or you just were one building a year? Or one building
sort
at a time.
One building at a time, because it would take a congressional appropriation to fund a project that big.
Right.
So at that time period, those buildings were still a several million dollar project and multi-year. I can think of some buildings that got stretched out from the time that we stabilized the building to the time that when it was restored, it might have been in the, 5 to 8 year range.
Wow. Well, that railroad depot is a huge building. I can imagine that took a while.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, nowadays, it takes all those same skills to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole different mindset in terms of how that can be accomplished in an active business district for, let's say, 4 to 5 months out of the year, where you might have 10,000 people on the street in a particular day. And so if you're trying to move around with equipment or taking the storm windows off of the building, and there's lots of those, you really have to do some planning.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, it being a living park, kind of.
Yeah.
And how you work around all those people.
It's almost like a contract between the city and the Park Service in terms of how can you occupy the street.
Yeah. And I can imagine that was not an always an easy relationship or thing to solve back and forth between the city and the park.
Well, the city of Skagway is a unique place. And I can't say that I've ever seen any real conflict. I've seen people that didn't get along or disagreed, but in the end, they were still your neighbor.
That's pretty good for a small town. It doesn't always work that way.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
There was something else. Oh, the historic architect I was thinking of was from Anchorage, was Steve Peterson.
Yes, I worked for him.
He was out of Anchorage, though.
Right.
Yeah.
And he was very significant in some of the early work in Skagway, and then he got involved in Wrangell St. Elias up at Kennicott. Mm-hmm. And that became his focus. So now I work with Grant Crosby, mm-hmm. who took over from Steve right. Peterson.
And, you know, we talk about how they do all this historic research, but it sounds like you did a lot of your own historic research. You know, you mentioned that police officer in Nome and that woman. Did you guys, or you did your own research just out of curiosity, or did it help you with your work?
I consider myself an amateur historian. And It helps me to understand what was happening in a different time period in our country. Like out here, there's Slavin's Roadhouse, 100 miles down the river from Eagle, and he was an interesting character. He stayed in that valley for probably 30 years. And then he eventually sold off his mining claims and the roadhouse to the larger mining company that came in there and brought in the dredge. And he went to Seattle and lived. And I was looking at his the article about his death in a newspaper. Okay, so, and they were talking about how he was an Eagle, a fraternal order of Eagle.
Oh, right.
And that was a big outfit in Skagway. It was kind of a development of the miners groups mm-hmm. that came about. And, you know, like, there's the Pioneers of Alaska.
Right.
And stuff like that. So it's to me very interesting how things have changed but somewhat stay the same, mm-hmm. you know, and that I worked with Chris Allen, the regional historian for this park.
Right.
And you know, to think that there were 100 steamboats going up and down this river.
Yeah.
And that you could get anything from French champagne to San Francisco oysters that were fresh.
Wow.
And the impact of what the gold rush was like then was in some ways similar to what the impact of what the pipeline was like in Alaska. Mm-hmm. There was lots of money flowing free and easy, and
that's a good comparison. Yeah. When you started all this work, you know, saying, I'm a carpenter, or what? Give me a job. Did you have that interest in history? Where does his passion come from?
My family moved from upstate New York to California when I was about 8 years old. And we lived in the Lake Tahoe area where the California Gold Rush started. So at a very early age, I could see these famous places where mining had changed the course of history. Mm-hmm. And I can remember going out as a kid and seeing mine shafts that were dug by hand with a pick and a shovel. And the famous gold rush towns, like there's the town of Bodie, California, I think it is, or I'm not sure if it's Nevada, but anyways, the expression was, goodbye God, I'm going to Bodie, you know, and I got to see a lot of history of that, traveling with my family, and some of it rubs off.
Mm-hmm. And you did mention going to UAF. Did you complete a degree at UAF?
I did not. I was studying to be a natural resources major, and I had some great teachers, and I thought Fairbanks was a good school. I just didn't want to live there in the wintertime anymore. Mm-hmm. So after the pipeline, I decided it was time to look for something else.
And you never got the degree?
Nope. My dad was not very pleased about that.
Where did you learn your carpentry skills?
I actually was an apprentice carpenter on the pipeline for a while.
Okay. Did you grow up doing carpentry with your dad or somebody? Or?
My dad and my two grandfathers were carpenters all together and built houses.
Okay.
And to be honest with you, I never thought I had an interest in it until I had a chance to get into the Carpenters Union in Fairbanks during the pipeline.
So your dad and grandfathers didn't teach you, or you didn't?
Well, they did somewhat, and I was always exposed to it.
But you weren't out there pounding nails with them?
No. No, I was too young when we left although I can remember sitting in my grandfather's basement cutting blocks of wood on his bandsaw while he was sharpening his, you know, razor. So I kind of feel, and I talked about it with my dad, and he says, I don't know how you ever got that stuff, but you're just like Uncle Glenn, who was the mortician that made the carpenters made the coffins.
In your family?
Yeah.
Oh, well, yeah, maybe it came down through that.
Who knows? But
that's funny. Well, yeah, it sounds like you've been very fortunate to be able to combine an interest in skill in carpentry and an interest in history.
Yes, and you know, that's something that I still pursue. I mean, I recently, you know, when you're out here in Eagle, and it's the easiest thing to do is to buy a book on Amazon. It comes right to your post office box.
Right.
And so I recently purchased a book about tools, carpenter tools, that goes back to the Romans.
Wow.
And sometimes all you have to do is look at a picture of some of those things, and it can give you ideas of how to do things. Like clamps.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody need, the saying is, you can never have too many clamps. But then, how have clamps changed since the Romans?
Have they?
Not really. It's, you got some kind of a bar, and you got some kind of a fixture on each end of it, and then you have a wedge that jams it in and makes it tight.
Well, and yeah, it used to be, you know, metal C clamps, and now they're those plastic ones that you can clamp it down. Yeah. So that's why I was going to say the concept is still the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. Isn't there some saying about building a better hammer or something?
I know about building a better mousetrap.
Oh, maybe that's it. Maybe that's the one I'm thinking of. So you sort of mentioned it, but when you go back to Skagway and you look at all those buildings and how they look now, what is your response personally to that? How does that make you feel?
I take pride in it. And I have been involved in the work that goes on there recently, to the point where I'm still trying to train people in those skill sets. And I make sure that I let them know if I see something that is contrary to what I would consider to be the standards that we fought so hard to uphold. So that, and a lot of times it can take somebody else coming in to see something that they look at every day and they don't even think about it. I'm going, what was going on here? Because that's backwards.
Oh, and is some of that for historical accuracy?
You wanna, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because there is a responsibility to preserve the past with its original integrity instead of making it into Disneyland.
Mm-hmm. And do you think Klondike Park has succeeded at that?
For the most part, yes. I'm not privy to all the decision making. Sometimes I don't understand why some things take so long. But I can say that I've seen people that came to town with a backpack that are now at the management level. And I know that I had a small part in helping to establish their parameters of philosophy on work. Mm-hmm. And they worked with me when they knew not much more than how to use a shovel. Mm-hmm. And now they're leaders. So I think Skagway has kept its integrity. It's a very expensive operation to maintain, let's say, 15 historic buildings. Mm-hmm. And it takes people with special skill sets that aren't always in demand all over the place these days. There's so much emphasis on changing things to modern materials. And of course, the Park Service has a responsibility to maintain those buildings in perpetuity, you mm-hmm. know, so that's a long time.
Well, and as you say, are people going to continue to know how to do those, I want to say, traditional skills or those more finished carpentry hand skills?
Right. Now, as an example, there's a restoration project going on up here at the fort.
Mm-hmm.
And it was mostly lead paint remediation. But they were doing some things like working on the windows and stuff like that. And And it was an outfit from Anchorage, and I can see where there's a huge difference between BLM and the National Park Service for the quality workmanship. But for the most part, it's their intent that you have to recognize. Mm-hmm. And the buildings up there are pretty special.
Yeah.
Steve Peterson originally started out here.
Oh.
Working on those.
On the Fort Egbert?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Huh. Well, and I was thinking, too, there were challenges or frustration with the Park Service. I mean, the appropriation you mentioned that kind of implied that that might be a challenge, but other things.
Oh, there's politics, yeah, sure.
If that affected, you know, your work. I know it affects all kinds of other jobs, but sure. If it affected the restoration crew.
Yeah, well, sometimes the funding wasn't there. Or there was a time period when they actually cut us all loose. And they said, okay, we don't need these skilled craftsmen anymore. We just need people to maintain this stuff. Well, they were wrong about that. Mm-hmm. And I think, even made an effort to recognize some of those mistakes and to change the way that they train people and develop better managers. It's always going to be a fight for money. That's just the nature of those kinds of projects, and whether it's in the, you know, the state or all these different federal agencies or whoever, it's always a battle. I went to work for Fish and Wildlife Service for 3 years because nothing was happening with the Park Service. And I went to the Kenai Peninsula and worked at that wildlife refuge. And it was eye-opening to see another Department of the Interior agency that you could tell at one point in time had been really big and was just being stripped right down to the bare bones. Mm-hmm. So, and that's, I kind of think that's what happened to BLM out here.
Yeah.
They used to be a lot more visible. And I think some of that was in relationship to the bad press that they got for mm-hmm. some things, you know, but you know, there were times when Park Service planes or vehicles were getting burned.
Right. No, out here for sure. So were you ever a crew boss?
Not really, no. I didn't see that was something I was interested in.
Well, yeah, I would think once you moved into the specialty of doors and windows, you probably were kind of your own unit.
Yeah, I got to run the shop.
Yeah.
That was, until they put me in a boat out here, that was the greatest.
Right. So now the being out in the boat's the greatest. But, yeah, so you were in charge of the doors and windows on those old buildings in Skagway, and you had people who worked under you that you trained, and they helped with the work.
Yes.
Okay.
So you have other...
because it was too much for you to do all by yourself.
Right.
Okay.
You need painters. You need people that are maybe not as skilled but are trying to learn. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at the way these things were dealt with traditionally, it wasn't unheard of to have a 5-year apprenticeship.
Right. That's true.
And you have to start by sweeping the floor. Somebody's going to do it.
Right. I know that, I think Grant Crosby mentioned to me that he had did some help with private structures in Skagway who were doing their own renovations, and he would maybe consult with them or help them get grant funding and things like that, part of his role with the Park Service. Did you do any work to help private businesses or private owners on their buildings?
Yes, in that one of the projects that Grant is referring to there is called the Portland House, and I worked on that primarily for a period of time. And it was a very important historic structure because it was built by Captain Moore. Mm-hmm. And he was truly the founder of Skagway. And just to show you how complicated all this time is, Captain Moore would carry the mail from Juneau up through here to Circle in the winter time when he was more than 50 years old.
Wow.
The guy was hardcore.
So, from Juneau...
Over the White Pass.
Over, oh, through Skagway, over White Pass, and then down the Yukon.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so what was that like working on the Portland House? What did you do for them?
Well, that building was from a time period when what we would call standardized framing didn't exist. So it's what I call a curtain wall. It was pretty much hung from a plate at the top, and the boards were nailed on vertically, and then there was a base at the bottom, and that was it. There were no studs in the wall.
How did it stay up?
Well, that's a good question. And Captain Moore was an old German, and he would change his nationality depending on where he was. But he built that building on a quadrant plan. So it's like four different divisions in how the building comes together. And I could actually see where he ran out of one kind of nail, and he probably had to get in his rowboat and go to Juneau and get another keg of nails. Hmm. Something like that, you know. And plus, I had worked on other buildings that he had in Skagway. He had a homestead that the Park Service has. So you kind of get to know these people a little bit. And that, you know, he homesteaded the valley in Skagway, and then the Stampeders show up, kick him out.
Yeah.
And he goes to court and eventually settles with White Pass for a substantial amount of money in terms of what he lost and what they gained. He was not done. He went to the gold rush in Nome. And I have been to places in South America where he was pursuing a gold rush down there, in Peru, of all places.
Wow. So on the Portland House, did you help them with the structure or just with the doors and windows?
Both, yeah.
Because I know that they took off like all the siding and then it was a very diligent project. It was amazing what they did on that building.
Yeah, and this is two older people.
Yeah.
That are still doing it.
Yeah. Well, that's why I was amazed that the Park Service would help a private owner in Skagway. I mean, the building's in the historic district, I suppose. So that makes it the Park Service's responsibility. I don't know. Why did you help them?
Well, they had a grant.
Mm-hmm.
And now, I can't say that I understand this relationship completely, but my understanding is if you have a legitimate historic structure that is significant, you can ask the Park Service for help, and that's part of what they're in business to do.
Okay. And I'm sure Grant explained it in his interview, but
I'm just kind of...
Right, but it did occur to me that you must have helped them on that building.
Yeah, and you know, they were working with grant money, so they couldn't do it themselves. And they were seriously trying to save that building so that it wasn't torn down.
Right.
Now, in my research, I would say that building was the first two-story building in Skagway and helped to establish what became a very prominent corner on the street system. And so the trail that went out of Skagway went right past that place. And then later on, the city hall was directly across the street, and that's where they had the jail where they put Soapy Smith's gang and all that kind of stuff. And Captain Moore was just this incredible character at that time.
Yeah. But it sounds, I mean, you mentioned Captain Moore's house and the cabin there. You worked on those.
Yeah.
You worked on the panel. Did you work on every single historic building in Skagway that the Park Service owns?
I would just say most of them. They've actually inherited some buildings since then. And there are some other buildings out in Dyea that are kind of on their plate now. But I got to work on the city hall. That was a big project. And then, of course, you know, there was always moonlighting, like, or periods when I wasn't working directly for the park, so I might be working for somebody else that had a historic building downtown that needed to have a section of the floor repaired or something like that, you know. So,
and I know that Skagway has this historic district, and they have, was it the Historic District Commission or something that sets all the rules and standards for appearance to look historic and all that. And I know the Park Service had representatives on that. Did you ever have any interaction with that group, or you were just told what they decided?
Well, that group, more than actual, most of the restoration work was about existing structures. So the Historic District Commission had to do with, like, say, lettering on signs, paint colors, stuff like that. Not necessarily architecture. Okay. I mean, sometimes they did because, you know, that period of the country's development, there were elaborate storefronts, and sometimes they would have like big awnings on them, mm-hmm. fabric awnings with metalwork that would roll up or collapse or all mm-hmm. that kind of stuff, and they would be involved in that. So I've had friends that have served on that board, but I never had to directly go to them and ask for permission to do something.
Okay. That's kind of what I assumed, yeah. that it didn't overlap with what you were doing, but I just wanted to make sure, because windows, you know, lettering on yep. windows.
Yep, that's a big part.
Okay.
Or can you put, and of course, this even became an issue with the Park Service, can you put thermopane glass in a historic-looking window?
What was the decision?
I go back to the picture description that I made earlier. Mm-hmm. If you take a black and white photograph, is it going to look the same? I would say in some places it's perfectly reasonable.
So who makes that final decision? You as the carpenter, builder, or the historic architect?
Sometimes it's a collaboration. I did put thermopane windows in a historic building in Nome. Mm-hmm. And it was a private residence. It was a building that had been built by the three Swedes, the guys that mm-hmm. found the Golden Gnome, and the building was originally a saloon, but it's now a residence, and I certainly could understand why those people were hoping that thermopane windows might help to
right.
make their abode a little warmer.
Right, but I was thinking like in Skagway where they're Park Service buildings and there's sort of protocol. Could you make that decision on your own, or you'd have to like go up through the right. chain? And
no, I wouldn't make that decision. That most of the time I'd be given a set of very elaborate architectural drawings.
And so if you wanted to put thermopane, you'd go back to the historic architect and discuss it with them?
Right.
Yeah. It does seem like a very close working relationship between a historic architect and the builders in historic restoration, and that relationship and getting along with each other is key.
Yes. It's a very unusual relationship, I think, in the workplace. Mm-hmm. In some respects, I always said that architects think that they are close to God because they can draw a straight line. Whereas in the world, really, there are no straight lines.
Well, I would say as a carpenter, you need to be able to draw a straight line so you can cut a straight line so the building is straight. Because I cannot cut a straight line. Let's put it that way.
Well, I can understand that.
And especially if you're doing windows and doors that have to fit in a certain spot.
Yeah. So I've known Grant Crosby since I believe he was coming up as an intern. Mm-hmm. And a couple summers ago, he had his whole family out here camping for the 4th of July, you know. And and he has sent me to work in places, him and Steve Peterson. Like, I've had people say, well, so you have to have these mobile shops, right? And I'm going, yeah. Well, where do you go? I said, I've had a mobile shop and like the city mortuary, or in the alley of a bowling alley, you know, where in between the lanes of, wow, a bowling alley, and just on my computer at home, I've got a screensaver shot from working on this customs building over here, mm-hmm, after the flood in Eagle, and I pretty much have the Yukon River and Eagle Bluff in the background, and I'm just set up outside.
Yeah.
Because it was warm, dry, sunny spot.
Have tools, will travel.
Yeah.
As I said, I think it sounds like you've been pretty lucky.
I think so, yeah. And I'm going to turn 70 next year, so I'm thinking that I don't want to work full time, and hopefully my luck will hold out and some interesting projects will still come my way.
So looking back on your career so far, it's not over, so far, what do you think about it? What do you assess it?
Well, I've got to see some interesting places. I was going out to Midway Atoll for several years. I ended up spending about a year total time out there. And it was very interesting because it was equidistant from Honolulu and Dutch Harbor in the middle of the ocean.
Wow.
With about 2 million birds.
Wow. What were you doing out there?
I was working on a telegraph station.
Oh. For the Park Service? No.
Well, through it was sort of through the Park Service, and that I was contracted, mm-hmm, and the Park Service was involved, but Midway Atoll was, of course, the famous battle during World War II, mm-hmm, and it was a naval air station. It was a place that had special status. It didn't belong to a state. It wasn't part of Hawaii. It just belonged totally to the U.S. government. An insular possession. Mm. And there's a very few places in the world that they have those. So when the Naval Air Station left, it became a wildlife refuge. And it has changed in that configuration until it was actually George Bush created a huge marine sanctuary out there. And so it was the only time that I've ever worked on a project where historic buildings were being torn down to make more bird habitat for albatross.
Was that painful?
Well, I had a pretty good gig there for a while, and I got to save one building.
Okay.
So I was getting sent to a half a dozen other buildings to scrounge up everything that I could.
Yeah. I would think that, yeah, how does that feel if you can't save a building?
Well,
and has that happened in other places?
I guess I would say that, you know, there's so much digital information these days that somewhere at some point in time, somebody's going to come across some photographs or some kind of records of what happened here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, right out here in front of us is what at one time was called Belle Isle.
Mm.
And there was a Frenchman that had a trading post on there. My understanding is that during the flood, everything was wiped clean.
Mm-hmm.
They could see where the foundation was. And that was before the gold rush. So things come and go. You know, it's mm-hmm. kind of like when the archaeologists are out here a couple weeks ago and they're going, well, see, Don, that's the White River ash right there from the volcano.
Oh.
And the oral history of the natives around, let's say, Kluane Lake,
mm-hmm.
that volcanic eruption is part of their history. And they talk about when the Yukon River flowed the other way, which is hard to imagine, right. But anything's possible, right?
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah, well, cool. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you about this.
Now, is there anything else that you would like to share about Skagway and working for Klondike and all those years, your experiences?
Just that I made some good friends there. It gave me a way to make a living, and I still hold it dearly in my heart.
And any particular individuals you'd like to name, or people who were mentors or particularly important to you?
Well, not that I can think of at the moment.
Okay. You're a self-made man. anyway, well, thank you very much.
All right.
It's been very interesting.
Thank you.
All right.